Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. I expect that most of us are familiar, at least in general terms, with the notion that nature abhors a vacuum. Really tempting to me to get into the philosophy and history of that particular phrase. I'm going to stick with the most basic idea here because basically I want to use it as a jumping off point for something else. So you can accuse me of reductionism or something if you like, but just stay with me. The basic idea is usually attributed to Aristotle. And the idea as Aristotle articulated it and wrote it down is that nature doesn't allow for true emptiness and that any open space will be occupied. And the thinking behind that is that in nature, empty spaces or voids are naturally unstable, and they're going to be filled by more stable or more weighty surrounding matter or energy. All right, thus ends the lesson in early physics, because now I want this to become a metaphor. So metaphorically, the corollary in life is that any unfilled space or gap is going to be quickly occupied by something else, whether that's a positive or a negative something. Now, there are so many potential problems with that idea, but also I think there's quite possibly something there that resonates or rings true to us, and it might be something like this. In our own lives, in the world around us, we can see that not choosing can also be a choice. My insightful partner occasionally reminds me of this. That old saying, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything, comes to mind. So all of those ideas, as I've offered them so far, have been set up primarily as either or, all or nothing sorts of choices, and that's part of the problem. Life is rarely, maybe never, at the risk of being either or. That's simple. However, I think that we can also see something intriguing here, which we might characterize as the hazardous nature or the vulnerability of not considering what we believe and why we believe it. So, seen from that vantage point, exploring what we believe isn't a luxury. It's not actually checking a good habits box or just a way to pass some time. It's actually an essential human task. It's actually something we really need to do. To hold unconsidered beliefs is perhaps to hold less substantive, or to use the language of Aristotelian physics, less stable beliefs. Also some problems there, but also something intriguing, right? As we've talked about even this morning in our community time. We'll touch on this in a moment, but what's the difference between stable and immovable? Anyway, that space, if we're not careful with it, we can end up with beliefs that are more vulnerable to being usurped or replaced by whatever surrounds them that has more mass or more momentum. That's one way to think about and talk about what a trend is, isn't it? On the other or balancing side of this way of thinking is the importance of considering not only what beliefs we hold, but how we hold them. Taya, my daughter, likes to illustrate this by, when she talks with people about it, by talking about the notion that she carries what she believes in a backpack. And it's her backpack, she carries it. But she's like, wouldn't it be kind of weird if what I did was I took my backpack off and I started slugging people with it? Right, so it's not just it's not just what you hold, it's how you hold it, right? It's a pretty lovely way to picture that. So the question, another way to articulate that, a question is, where's the line between confidence and hubris between I believe this enough to have it give direction to my life choices and I don't care what comes along, I won't reconsider what I believe. Is there a line? What's that space? In this space at the table, I've often shortened that dilemma or that challenge to saying that there's a difference between confidence and certainty as a way of trying to put simple words around big ideas. And when I look around at our current cultural context, I feel as though there's a noteworthy vacuum of considered beliefs, and what's flowing into that vacuum often isn't good or helpful. And one of the ways that shows up is the tendency to avoid complexity and tilt toward either or thinking, speaking, and behaving, to the binary. And that is a way of operating that assails many aspects of how we relate to one another as human beings, and it leads to sometimes utterly nonsensical ways of interacting with one another. This is a news story that popped up in my sidebar earlier this week. I'm not sure what it says about my browsing habits. You might have seen this story, I don't know. But the story as it was reported last week was a story about four residents of a Detroit area senior citizens apartment complex. The initial police report suggested that there'd been a shooting incident, which was that one man had shot another one, the shooting victim being someone who was in a wheelchair, and the motivation was it was in response to loud music at a barbecue. But when they actually went to investigate, it turned out that the motive at the heart of the attack was, I think, considerably more interesting. Regina Irvin, longtime resident of the senior apartment, talked to this one of the Detroit broadcasters, and he said that the whole thing was the violent culmination of a known love triangle between tenants. I think context is important in understanding your picturing this. So, quote, "I've been here 6 years. I know everything that's going on. It was a love triangle. The shooter said he was going to kill him, and that's what he said he was going to do," close quote. Second part of that didn't add much to the first, but anyway, there you go. So it turns out that Irvin and other residents explained that that one-third of this triangle was upset that a 65-year-old woman that he was romantically interested in, who's identified in the news story as Johnny, started dating someone new in the complex, and that new interest, the 70-year-old man in the wheelchair, was shot at the party. The shooting suspect is also believed to be in his early 70s. According to witnesses, the gunman shot Johnny's new boyfriend and two others. Then somebody else at the party tackled him, knocked the gun from his hand, and then Johnny grabbed the gun and shot the gunman in self-defense. Back to the article, quote, "No charges have been brought at this time. Detroit Assistant Police Chief Arnold Williams called the shooting ridiculous." Quote, "This is a shooting so ridiculous in nature that you can't even imagine it," Williams said. "We're having incidents again where people can't resolve common issues. You don't have to resort to a gun because somebody is playing loud music. It's just irrational. You're in your 70s. This should not be what's going on," close quote. So I think it'd be fair to paraphrase that last bit as something like, by the time you're 70, you should have learned better ways of dealing with differences in conflict than shooting someone. My mom would just say, "You should know better." Like that, you know, she would shorten it to that. And I'm gonna take that as a reasonable thought. There are better ways, and have that be my starting point for suggesting what I'm calling equanimity this morning. Anyway, what a bizarre story. I read someone this past week who called equanimity the holy grail of calmness and grace, which is, I think, an interesting combination of ideas. We didn't all grow up around this mythology of the holy grail. Some of us might remember it appearing in the Indiana Jones film, The Last Crusade. In the traditional myth, the Holy Grail is the cup that Jesus drank from during the Last Supper, and which Joseph of Arimathea, the person who provides a tomb for Jesus' body, uses to collect Jesus' blood at the crucifixion. It's all rather visceral. And the cup is extant. It's around somewhere as an artifact in the mythology, and if you can find it and drink from it, you get eternal life. So that's the mythology of the Holy Grail. And I won't get into the part that it plays in the movie. Suffice it to say that it involves Nazis and Indy saving his dad. So translated into our consideration of equanimity, what this person who wrote the sentence describing the equanimity as the holy grail of calmness and grace, what that person was saying was that to drink deeply of or to take into ourselves equanimity is to receive calmness and grace. That was the analogy they were making. So when I consider that idea, receiving calmness and grace, practicing equanimity, when I consider that idea as a possible alternative to either or thinking or solving our, you know, romantic disaffections with a gun, that sounds worth exploring to me. Now, that news story might feel like a pretty unlikely scenario in most of our lives, not just because we're not residents in a senior's home. But having said that, none of our lives are without some challenges, without some stormy weather. And every week when we sit down together in this space, like we did today, and we have the opportunity to share a bit of our lives with one another, there are things that we're dealing with that are hard, that are difficult. I had a conversation early this past week with a longtime acquaintance, someone who's a fair bit younger than me, but whom I've known since they were probably 18 or so, and whose wife had recently died of cancer. So they're both partners in their late 30s, early 40s, and leaving him to raise two late adolescent kids, without his partner. And he said something in that conversation that struck me as hard-won wisdom. He said that those events in his life don't mean that he has a bad life. They mean that he's alive. That's the meaning of those events. Life includes challenges, and most of us might find it at least a little bit uncomfortable to think about, but there's really no reason why those challenges might not come to us just as well as they might come to someone else. And I don't mean this in any kind of uncaring way, and if you feel like you're actively suffering and this rubs you the wrong way, I can appreciate that. But given the sometimes random vicissitudes of life, why not me is actually, in many ways, a more reasonable question than why me? They're really both exploration launchers, aren't they? They're not answerable questions. They're just fundamental human explorations. We can't control what happens around us. We can't control the events of life, as much as it might seem comforting to behave as though we can. I'm not saying we have no agency, but I'm differentiating between agency and control here. So what can we do to find a calm harbor that we carry with us when life is stormy? How can we develop our ability to remain composed and centered when we're faced with challenges so that we don't become the person who shoots first, literally or metaphorically, and then lives with regret later? And one possible path into that kind of a space lies in the practice of equanimity. Not a new idea, of course. Equanimity is an ancient virtue in lots of different spiritual and philosophical traditions. In the Hebrew tradition, for example, on which the Judeo-Christian tradition stands, God is described in Exodus as slow to anger. So that's an equanimous picture, notion of the divine. Right, it's a way of thinking of God in a particular way. In Proverbs, which I personally think is one of those parts of the biblical library that anyone can benefit, no matter what we believe or don't believe about the divine, we find this particular beauty. Whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. I was thinking that a good thing to do with that little nugget of wisdom would be to write it on a sticky note and paste it on the border of whatever screen you watch the news on, and just observe how profoundly it is in contrast to the actions of many of today's power brokers. As an interesting aside, it's worth noting that the ancient gendered language of he is still most often on target on this one. Also worth noting that in Proverbs, wisdom, of course, is characterized in the feminine, and predates in Hebrew mythology the existence of God. Wisdom is there in Hebrew mythology before the divine is anthropomorphized in those stories. It's a fascinating order in which, so wisdom is actually the source of the divine, not the other way around. Anyway, different day. The text itself is actually pretty nuanced, because in the text as we have it, the wise person, and in Proverbs, that's the goal, to live a wise life, which the Hebrew understanding of wisdom could be nicely summarized as skill for living. So to live skillfully is to be wise in this context. So the wise person in this context isn't someone, if we just pay attention to these particular words, isn't someone who stuffs, denies, or crushes their emotions. They rule them, they feel them, and they govern them, which, by the way, is also a pretty fantastic short definition of emotional intelligence. In that light, this seems to me like another one of those contemporary science proves the ancient or obvious to be true, because this is also a real hot topic for modern psychologists these days. And one of the reasons that that's the case is because it works. It makes a difference. Wisdom, as it occurs in Proverbs and as we experience it in the rest of life, is about things that work. It's about living skillfully. It's about stuff you can actually plug in and do different and better. And so that we would find that intersection here isn't a huge surprise. All right. So I've been tossing this word equanimity around like it was every day, and although I expect most of us have some idea of what it means, we might never have really taken a closer look at it. It's not typically in high rotation in our everyday speech, as in, hey, Scott, I don't know where I got Scott from, hey, Scott, in that heated team meeting, I really appreciated your equanimity. You know, like it's just not the thing that we usually end up saying. So in our exploration of this, I'm going to move to a bit of what does this mean, where does it come from, and then we'll move on to some thoughts about why and how we might practice it. We're not going to wrap that up today, but we're going to kind of get a little further down the on-ramp. So the word itself means the practice of maintaining mental calmness and evenness of temper, especially in challenging situations. So that's a fairly embracing, if we think about the literature around this these days, that's a fairly embracing definition of equanimity. Kind of what you'd expect, I think, right? For the word nerds among us, I know you're out there. Some of you might even be in the room. It comes from a combination of, surprise, two Latin terms, equus, which means even or level, and animus, which means mind or spirit. So if we go back to the history of the word, equanimity basically is a level spirit, which is an interesting picture. I'm a bit of a DIY person, and I find it helpful to think about this in terms of the physical level that I use when I'm building construction projects, which has historically, amusingly to me, been called a spirit level because of the makeup of the bubble. That device, in my experience, is utterly unperturbed by my perspective. It doesn't care how much I disagree with it, how much I shake it around, how much I tilt it. It just comes back to level. That's equanimity, right? What it looks like in action is the ability to remain calm, composed, open, and non-reactive in the face of challenging or distressing situations. And as I've just alluded to, non-reactive doesn't mean unfeeling, right? So this is a really important, given where we're headed here in a moment. You can't see it coming, but I can. So I wanted to set that up. This is important because there's a marked difference in how this idea has historically been understood in what we might broadly call Western thinking and Eastern thinking. In the Western traditions, the Stoics have been an enduring school of thought that values equanimity. They articulated it this way, and this stuff shows up in lots of positive psychology work as well, this perspective, which, again, dominated by Western thought. Stoic philosopher Marcus Aurelius wrote it this way. He said, if you're distressed by anything external, the pain is not due to the thing itself, but to your estimate of it, and this you have the power to revoke at any moment. Typical philosopher, right? He totally neglected, he should have asked me, he totally neglected to insert the word ideally following the word and, right? The way it should read is like this. Marcus, if you're distressed by anything external, the pain is not due to the thing itself, but to your estimate of it, and ideally, you have the power to revoke this at any moment. Did this guy ever have any bad days? Like, I don't know about you, but I might definitely have days where I feel more like life is in charge of me than I'm in charge of life, right? And, you know, anyway, but this is detachment, of course. It's not that unusual for a Stoic philosopher. Anyway, what he's pointing to is the fact that we can't control the external causes of our distress. So if we want to take it into sort of the language of interpersonal or psychological vantage point, we can't control the stimuli that we experience, the things that act on us that might cause us distress, but we can control or have some influence or agency over or within what we think about those stimuli, those things that are impacting us. We can, in the words of Marcus here, we can revoke our understanding of those events, essentially change our mind about what they mean, which again is a pretty short description of cognitive behavioral therapy if you want to look at it through a therapeutic lens, perhaps. Different Stoic, Epictetus, wrote it this way. It was even punchier. Man is affected not by events, but by the view he takes of them. Epictetus was also a Stoic philosopher and the teacher of Marcus Aurelius, so that adds up in terms of idea flow. In light of what we're considering, it's interesting to me that Epictetus was born into slavery. As events go, that's kind of a biggie. He was also, as far as we know, someone who lived with a substantial physical disability. When we see him illustrated, it's almost always with his crutch. To him, all external events are beyond our control. Not someone writing from the vantage point. He eventually moves out of slavery, but never moves out of poverty. And it's from that vantage point that he's making this argument. And he argues that we should accept whatever happens calmly and dispassionately. But, not an insignificant but, and there's a real tension between these, like between, I think, most important ideas. He held that as individuals, we are responsible for our own actions, which we can examine and control. And the path to that, from his vantage point, was self-discipline. Right? We have to engage with them in a disciplined way. We'll come back to that later in exploring some of these ideas. That's not a very appealing perspective if what we're inclined to do is blame our circumstances or other people for the way that we're thinking or acting, which is kind of a default setting for most of us as humans, right? When was the last time you were in a heated discussion with somebody that you cared about and you found yourself saying, well, if you, at the start of a sentence, right? And then going on to explicate yourself of your behavior by saying, if you hadn't done that, I wouldn't have done this. You're responsible for my behavior, right? That's sort of the short interpersonal version of not behaving the way these philosophers would talk about it, instead of standing back and going, I can't control what that person does. As appealing a thought as that might be, probably be disastrous if we could actually do it, but sometimes in theory we think it's a nice thought, but we want to hand off our behavior to them instead of looking at that and going, where's my agency? What can I do something about here? And what do I believe about that? Because that's what really affects how I act and interact. And what I believe is what I can change. That's the movable bit, right? Can't control the stimulus, and my actions are the product of my belief, right? So if that's a chain of events, stimulus, what I believe, how I act, this middle bit right here, that's where the action is. I have access to what I believe, and it's adjustable. That's Marcus Aurelius' whole point. Whether we like that perspective or not, the quotations pretty neatly capture this idea that equanimity results from a carefully cultivated mindset, a calm inner attitude that makes us more resilient, at the very least, maybe not in the absolute sense that Aurelius uses the language, but makes us more resilient to the effects of external events. The other side of this, if you want to continue sort of down that east-west path a little bit, the other dominant stream of thought about this, the Eastern perspective, is dominated by Buddhist teachings, which consistently place a very high value on equanimity. And according to Buddhist beliefs, we often relate to our experiences through a lens of craving, attachment, or aversion. And any one of those lenses has a tendency to increase suffering. Suffering is a baseline in Buddhist teaching. We all suffer. That's the given. How we experience the suffering can vary. And this is the entry point for how it can vary. So Buddhists understand equanimity as an antidote to all of those, to craving, attachment, and aversion, and would describe it as this way. This is, again, sort of a summary of a lot of different ideas about this, as a balanced reaction to joy and misery, which protects one from emotional agitation. So from the extremes, right? The central notion here is one of balance, even-mindedness, a level spirit. Interesting intersection in terms of language, because the Buddhist teachings didn't evolve in the same space that the definition for equanimity that I gave you did in terms of the history of ideas. But they really do meet around a level spirit. It's also interesting to me that in Buddhist teachings, equanimity is one of the four sublime or divine abodes of the mind. Now, well, I won't get into the deep water on this, but in other words, if we practice equanimity from the vantage point of those teachings, we might be said to have, or to be seeking to have, a divine mind. For those who choose to personify the divine, we could say that to seek and practice equanimity is to seek and practice having the mind of God, which is interesting, not least of all because it shows up as an idea in early Christian teachings, and of course there it shows up as to have the mind of Christ, the personification of the divine embodied, right? So, and Jesus, as we have the stories, is also a pretty decent example of equanimity. Not someone without emotion, but someone who has a level spirit. It's kind of an interesting thing to examine from that vantage point. In Buddhist teaching, Equanimity is also important because of its profound implications for personal well-being, ethical conduct, and spiritual development. Lots of those ideas have been showing up in the longer series we keep dipping in and out of that has to do with what it looks like to try to develop an ethic that is big enough to embrace religion but is not contained by religion, right? What does it look like to actually have something that's a wider human ethic within which those other systems of belief can operate? To live a life of equanimity from that vantage point is to treat all beings impartially and without discrimination, what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. It's not hard to imagine that possibility for me, although personally I find it the work of a lifetime to approach it as a practice. But it's not that hard for me to imagine how that lens could help me, could help us as human beings to transcend things that we struggle with all the time, like personal biases and prejudices and judgments, and that could lead us toward a more inclusive and a more harmonious outlook on life. As much as in our conversation earlier today, we talked a little bit about the comfort of certitude. We just sort of touched on it. The other side of that comfort is that my comfort with my certitude categorically creates discomfort around it for anyone or any system that doesn't share it, right? So this is a way of sort of trying to invert that, if you will. I don't know if I mentioned this in this space before, but And this is, I don't want to idealize something, but I do want to illustrate something. Relatively recently saw for the first time an indigenous scholar's version of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which of course is a triangle, like so many Western ideas we're still borrowing from the Egyptians with real vigor, right? Which has at the bottom of our basic needs, food, shelter, and so on, at the top about a self-actualized individual. The indigenous scholar had flipped that upside down. It's an inverted pyramid that starts with the arrival of an individual in the world, but as we grow as people, if we are growing well, we are growing toward being fully integrated in a community, that a mature human being is actually an integrated and community human being. So a complete inversion of Maslow's hierarchy, which I thought was fascinating. This idea of a way of looking at the world that can help us to transcend personal biases, prejudices, and judgments, that's an idea that's traveling in the direction of that notion. Right, of interbeing, of interdependence at the deepest, most fundamental level of human experience. If we grew up around Christian theology and Christian thought, this idea is there. It's just that it hasn't been the emphasis. The emphasis has been on Jesus and me, for example, if we grew up around evangelicalism, for example. My personal relationship with Jesus, which is how, you know, Bill Clinton could sort of famously get away with saying that his behavior with his intern was between him and Jesus. Anyway, where'd the community go, right? So that you can get away with that in this pyramid, but you can't get away with that in this pyramid. And so thinking about what it's like to live in a world where we actually don't start with my judgment as the most important thing, but we start with interdependence, interconnectedness as the most important thing, is present in Christian theology in the notion that we all come from the same source and we all return to the same source, which we'll encounter at a graveside service, for example, right? We all come from carbon and we all end up as carbon, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. If you want a more contemporary example, I've cited Malcolm Guite's poem about decay here on a number of occasions, right? That everything that grows, grows in something that has died and provided the food for what grows, the nutrients for what grows next. So the ideas are there. They're just not what's been broadcast most vigorously. And as we started out talking about the things that are broadcast most vigorously and with all this emphasis, if we aren't being thoughtful about what we're taking in, if we have a vacuum in our beliefs and the way we take them in, the things that are being broadcast most vociferously are what's going to end up in that space. They're going to fill it. If we're going to look at that through, you know, early Aristotelian physics, if we're going to use that nature abhors a vacuum idea to assess something like that. All right. We've just sort of begun to explore these ideas. I'd say we're already well into the consideration of far better ways of resolving challenging matters, like having someone in your senior's home putting the moves on your romantic interest, better ways than shooting that person. We're already sort of considering that there might be other ways to do that. The things that we've touched on here, for example, had they been part of that original shooter's way of looking at the world, might have helped them to consider the possibility that not getting involved with Johnny, who proved to be something of a shoot-first individual as well, was actually dodging a bullet. At least metaphorically speaking. Did you track that idea all the way through? Anyway, yeah. Maybe Johnny was the bullet. Yeah, that's not fair, of course. But to think like that, in that little news story's illustration, one would need some equanimity to help them, right? We would need something in our lives, in our practice, to help us rule our spirit, to be balanced. And that might take some practice. So, just in case we end up at some point on our journey in a senior's residence that operates kind of like Love Island, but with guns, we should probably get started now. Peace.